This public lecture was given in Auckland on the 16th of July 1974. It is the fifth in the series of lectures given in Auckland by Mr. Geoffrey Hodgson. This one is entitled Man's Undying Reincarnating Spiritual Self.
Mr. Eden and friends, last time we studied together, our study in the light of theosophy of the undying spiritual self of man gave us some ideas of our own eternal selves. One title being the human monad. Other titles you may remember help to understand that is which really is beyond the range of the conceptualizing intellect. Some of those titles were, you may remember, and I like to dwell upon them and meditate on them myself, a seed of the tree of life. Remember, the deep interior spirit essence, which is the reality of each one of us. Not this body, not even our reincarnating ego, but the source of both, as it were, the indwelling spirit essence within. And so these titles help us. A divine fragment, the dweller in the innermost, the spark within the one flame, the white brilliance, a breath of the great breath. Or as St. Paul put it, the living God, the Christ within, the hope of glory. You remember his reference, know ye not that ye are the temple of the living God and that the Spirit of God dwelleth in you. There he spoke with the great teachers throughout all ages, as the study of world scriptures reveals. But now, this evening and onwards, we will study that same eternal self of man at its present stage of development. All of us, where we are just now, as self-conscious human individualities, which are incarnated during physical life. If you like, yes, the dweller in the body. Strange thoughts, you know. This which we generally think of and refer to as ourselves isn't ourselves at all. And that I'm not, unless I use any kind of special faculty, if I had it, I'm not seeing you and you're not seeing me, but just a kind of covering of flesh for the purposes of thinking and seeing and hearing and tasting and smelling and walking about and living here on earth in a body. But we're going to see what the ancient teachers said about the thinker, which is within the body, the eternal self of man. It has terms, some of which are rather limiting. For example, the human ego. Ego there meaning I or self. Sometimes the students say the human ego in the causal body, which we shall be studying directly, the vesture at the higher levels of this spiritual being. And so now, purely for your consideration, I proffer theosophical ideas about the monad ego, which the Greeks, by the by, called the orgoides. What did that mean, orgoides? Well, one translation, the self-shining divine fragment. And that's their idea of their philosophers of the true self in all of us human beings. The self-shining divine fragment. Now we're going to study this, and rather closely, friends, because we are, in a way, students at a school. Well, first we're going to consider, if only an outline, the formation of this individuality of man called the monad ego from what is sometimes referred to as a group soul. And also the process of development through group soul living to individualization, meaning the arrival at the time where the monad has an individual entity. Now, in the subhuman kingdoms, that doesn't exist. There, in the mineral, in the plant, and in the animal kingdoms of nature, there is not generally found a single individual center of selfhood at all. But a large number of monads, all grouped together, evolving, say, through a mass of mineral, through a forest or a field of corn or of grass or other vegetation, and on into the animal kingdom, where the monads are fewer and fewer as the animal evolves through the wild into the developed and domestic state, until eventually a kind of miracle occurs, which we look at together, in which there is born, by the very magic and wonder of nature, there is born a kind of individual representation of the one supreme life through monad and as ego. Eventually, three very important phases of evolution are passed through for each monad. What are they? Well, first, I've just been referring to individualization and entry into the human kingdom of nature. Each person, one ego, one monad, scintilla of the spiritual sun. Individualization means the entry into singularity, or individuality, if you like. That's the first great event. The next one is, which we'll be looking at later, if you're interested, the entry of this interior spiritual self upon the path of self-directed haste and progress. Ah, that's a wonderful change. That's when there's a kind of wondrous hatching has gone on deep within us, until it becomes so powerful that it begins to take hold of the mere human personality, who find themselves impelled ever to seek to ascend the great ladder of life to greater and greater heights. It's called entry upon the path. And the third great event is the attainment of adeptship. Three stages, then, in the evolution of the monad. Individualization, entry into the human kingdom. Entry upon the path of self-directed, hastened progress. then eventually the attainment of adeptship, or, as St. Paul put it, until we all come in the unity of the faith and in the knowledge of the Son of God unto the perfect man, unto the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. Now, the life of the monad through the mineral, vegetable, and animal kingdoms represent intermediate stages leading up to complete differentiation and so into separate human identities like we are now. Hence, in the three kingdoms mentioned, we do not find one soul in one block of mineral, or in a plant, or in an animal. Instead, we find one block of life, if we may use such a term, ensouling a vast quantity of mineral substance, a large number of plants or trees, and a number of animals. And these are called, in our terminology, for helping us as students, group souls. One helpful analogy of a group soul is perhaps the old one of water in a bucket. If a glass full of water be taken from the bucket, it represents the soul or portion of soul of, say, a single plant or animal. And for the time being, the water in the glass is quite separate from that in the bucket. Moreover, it takes the shape of the glass which contains it. So may a portion of the group soul occupy and vivify a vegetable or an animal form. And so an animal, yes, by the by, animals do have souls. Not individual, reincarnating souls, but definitely a soul life. And an animal during its life on the physical plane, and yes, for some time afterwards, has a soul. But when it comes to the end of its life, that soul, its life after death, that soul doesn't reincarnate again in a single body. No, it returns as a whole to the group soul, which is a kind of reservoir of group matter. Just as if I poured this passed back into the source. So you see, the animal's death would, in our analogy, be represented by pouring the glass of water back into the bucket. And just as the water from the glass becomes thoroughly mixed and united with the water in the bucket, so does the portion of soul from the particular animal become mixed and incorporated, as it were, with the total group soul. It doesn't retain its individuality. And just, yes, and then let me carry this further, just as it would not be possible to take again from the bucket another glassful consisting of the same molecules of water, so it's not possible for the same portion of the total soul in the group soul to inhabit another particular animal form. It's spread out, do you see? So if you continue it further, if we could fill many glasses of water from the bucket at the same time, equally is it possible for many animal forms to be ensouled and vivified by the same group soul. Further, if we suppose that any given glassful of water becomes colored with a distinctive hue of its own, born of experiences, you see, and growing intelligences and other animal developments. We further suppose that any given glass full of water becomes coloured with a distinctive hue of its own. Then, when the water is poured back into the bucket, that colouring matter will be distributed throughout the whole of the bucket, all the water, and the colour of all the water in the bucket will be to some extent modified. And this goes on and on, through the mineral, through the plant, into the animal kingdom. And this goes on and on until what is called the process of individualization occurs. Let us look at it together. The teaching is, as I understand it, that differentiation begins to occur in group souls in the course of time. A certain segregation will take place within the group soul, and presently a filmy separating wall will grow inwards from the envelope, dividing these segregated groups from each other. Then again, reverting to the simile of the water in the bucket, we may conceive of a scarcely perceptible film mysteriously forming itself across the bucket. Hello, differentiation's beginning. At first the water filters through this barrier to some extent, but nevertheless, the water taken out from each side of the barrier always return to the same side. So that by degrees, do you see, the water on one side becomes differentiated from the water on the other. Differentiation's beginning. Part of the great process of nature, do you see. Then the barrier gradually densifies, eventually becomes impenetrable. So that then there are two distinct portions of water instead of one whole bucketful. Now, moving on, you see, we're getting nearer to individuality. In similar fashion, then, the group soul after a time divides itself by fission and forms two group souls, as I've said. And this culminates in what is called individualization, into a single unit. Large numbers of domestic animals have reached this stage. That's why it is they show such remarkable individuality, some of them, and high intelligence. More and more so now as we read from accounts of marvelous understanding and love and devotion and sacrifice even, which, and understanding, yes, which animals display. So large numbers, if I may repeat, of animals in this our day have reached this stage, have really become separate entities, incarnating in a succession of animal bodies, each more intelligent than the other, although they've not as yet attained to the possession of what I called at the beginning a causal body, which is the true mark of individuality. Now, how's that going to happen? Well, there are two main factors, apparently, which are involved. One, this, by the by, is very important to all of us. The emotions and the thoughts of man act constantly upon those of the animal and tend to raise him to higher levels, both emotionally and intellectually. He's in the play, you see, of our more highly developed capacity for feeling and thought. And the other factor is that the animal, if kindly treated, develops devoted affection for his human friend and also unfolds his intellectual powers, trying to understand his friend, to anticipate his wishes, and marvelously does so in many cases, I expect, as most of you have found out. By the way, I'm going to interrupt the flow for a moment. This does point, you know, to the great responsibility which we human beings have towards the animal kingdom of nature. They're not thrown into our presence just for nothing, or for our pleasure, or to be our servants or our pets and so on. There's a great purpose of nature being outworked there, and that is the play of our human capacities upon the animal capacity to quicken their evolution. And the results depend a great deal upon the relationship between. This is what I'm leading up to. This is where, surely, the great gospel and living out of humanitarianism and kindness to animals assumes a tremendous importance. We can either mar, twist, spoil, slow up the development of animals by our treatment of them, or quicken their evolution. We can torture them. We can experiment on them in full consciousness. We can beat and kill and eat them and treat them, all being free, of course, which is not a vegetarian society. But the effects are there of our treatment of either loving kindness, which, as it were, draws them out, or terrible, brutal cruelty, which, as it were, causes them to enclose themselves out of protection and fear into, undesirable forms of individuality. All this, my friends, all this influence of nature from within the indwelling life and from man upon animal, all this eventually becomes so strong that the animal in his way takes the kingdom of heaven by storm. Yes, and wonder of wonders, a spiritual soul is then born. Then a threefold being has come into existence and embarks upon the great evolutionary pilgrimage which will make of him an adept and later a great creative logos, perfect, even as his Father which is in heaven is perfect. As our Lord Jesus Christ stated. Now this brings us to our special study, which is the body of light, which is this new formed spiritual being, or in which it clothes. In theosophy, as I said, it's called the causal body. Why? Why should it be called the causal body? Well, I understand it owes its name to the fact that within this vehicle or vesture reside the causes which manifest themselves as effects in our thoughts, feelings, and actions. And these causes, of course, arise from our experiences, preceding experiences in life. And there is always being extracted, as it were, the very finest parts of human experience and character to be absorbed into the causal body. And as a result, following actions are, as it were, guided or caused. Hence, causal body. Or should I say, it's the experiences of past lives stored in the causal body, which in a way are the cause of the general attitude taken up towards life, yes, and the actions which follow. Now we could say that in the main, the causal body has two main functions. I've really almost described them, but let's look at them again. Two main functions of this vesture of life, in which the divine fragment is incarnated at the level of the higher mind. What are these two functions? What does the causal body do? Remember, we're thinking of ourselves, you know. You and I, the inner spiritual intelligence clothed in a vesture of light. Or as the old Gnostics called it, the robe of glory. Because it's said to shine, as we'll see directly. Well, this is what it does for us. It acts as a vehicle for the indwelling consciousness, a kind of vesture and means of existence and action for the true man, a thinker within. And secondly, the causal body acts as a receptacle or storehouse, if you like, for the essence of human experience through the various incarnations. For you know, this causal body is that into which everything is woven. By that is meant everything, of course, which can endure, and in which are stored the germs of qualities carried over from one incarnation to a successor. And this means that nothing is wasted that we ever grow into. No experience we pass through which produces a fruit, spiritual fruitage. No added faculty, capacity, touch of genius, understanding or intuition is ever wasted. It's all woven into the material of the causal body. So the causal body is that into which is woven everything which can endure and in which are stored the germs of qualities to be carried over to the next life. You and I here, as we sit here, meeting here, trying to understand these things and me to teach them, we are all the fruitage of our former lives. All of us. This isn't our first beginning. And we're all different, because our experiences have been different, though there are certain common human qualities in us all. Hence one sees that the lower manifestation of man, his expression in mental, emotional, and physical bodies, depends ultimately upon the growth and development of the real person himself. Now, at its inception, the causal body, or form aspect of the true man, it can be seen, by the by a great seer, by an appropriate seer. How does he describe it? Well, he or she records from their investigations that it's described at its inception, that will be a passage from the high type of animal to become a human being, the causal body of such a person would be like a delicate film of subtlest matter, just visible, marking where the individual begins his or her separate life. And that delicate, almost colorless film of subtlest matter, that's the body, which will last through the whole of human evolution. And on this, as on a thread, will all the future incarnations be strung, as it were. So the causal body, I may repeat, important part of our study, friends, the causal body is the receptacle of all that is enduring in us and which we develop. Only that which is noble and harmonious and in accordance with the law of spirit can be woven into the causal body. For every great and noble thought, every pure, yes, and lofty emotion is carried up, as it were, and its essence worked into the substance of the causal body, which is thus all the time being enriched, built, if you like. And so you see the causal body, this is the true register, the only true register of the growth of the man or woman, of the stage of evolution which has been attained. Now, what does it look like in a more advanced person? It's impossible, say the seers, to describe the causal body fully, because the senses belonging to the causal world are altogether different from those higher, yeah, ought I to say, higher than those which we employ here at the physical level. However, such memories of the appearance of a causal body as it is possible for a clairvoyant, for example, to bring into the physical brain, they describe it something like this, friends. They say it is an ovoid, gradually becoming more or less spherical. In the case of primitive man, it resembles a bubble, just sufficient to hold itself together, as it were. But as the man develops, then the matter is gradually stirred into alertness by vibrations from the activities of the human being in the bodies of thought and emotion and action. This comes slowly and gradually finds expression so that the causal body is aroused into greater activity, becomes filled with richer and richer colors, and increases in size. And wonderful though it is, it really is quite indescribable, because the inconceivably fine and delicate matter of such a causal body is intensely alive, pulsating with living fire, forming a radiant globe of flashing colors, and its high vibrations send ripples of changing hues over its surface all the time, hues of which our earth really knows nothing. Brilliant, soft, luminous, beyond the power of language to describe. If you could see yourself or others, this is something of the reality of each human being which you would see. A causal body, yes, filled with living fire, drawn from a still higher plane to which it is connected by a quivering thread of light. And then from the, from the upper part of the causal body, there ascends a crown of brilliant sparks, indicating the spiritual activity and aspiration, and of course, adding greatly to the beauty and dignity of the individual's appearance. And then come to something very strange, friends, now. Nearly all such seers who thus attempt to describe the spiritual living soul of a human being, they all say this. They say that within this aura of radiance, which, by the by, in the average person reaches out for a yard or more beyond, and as they evolve increasingly, until the aura of a really great person will reach for 100 yards or more, all shining with brilliance and with flashing color. Perhaps rays of light shooting out over the world still further as the real individuality becomes more and more a vehicle for the divine self. The spark of the one flame for which it is a vesture. Then the seers tell us, in addition to this, they say that within such a radiance there is to be discerned the likeness of a human form. Or, some I've heard and read, say, a human face. A divinely beautiful, spiritualized face. Or perhaps more and more of the body, like a Greek marble of Apollo. But, of course, not hardened like that from which the great statues, beautiful as they are, have been hewn. Another one has been described as resembling the Greek goddess of agriculture, Demeter, as in the British Museum, a dignified, serene, and peaceful figure within the inner self, brooding, as it were, over the world. And so it says that each human ego, and this applies to you and to me and all of us, we all have our own inner, radiantly beautiful appearance, expressing our particular mission or genius in the world, however great or however little may be the expression down here in the named personality. But you see, this teaching of theosophy helps you to, might I coin a word, disidentify yourself. But this isn't all there is, friends. This is only the densest, heaviest, least responsive vesture that this monad ego wears. We are studying the same being in the inner planes of nature, which I have, drawing upon other descriptions, attempted to describe. I thought, rather, that the great interests that run through a series of lives may play their part in the formation of this, what is sometimes called the divine face, which is there in a most immortal beauty, shining deep within the radiant causal body of an individualized human being. St. Paul must have known very well the nature of this divine robe of glory, as the Gnostics called it, a heavenly dwelling. For he said, St. Paul, 2 Corinthians chapter 5, first two verses, he wrote, "For we know that if our earthly house of this tabernacle were dissolved, we have a building of God," he called it. We have a building of God. "An house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed upon with our house which is in heaven." Same idea, for St. Paul presents these theosophical views so often in his letters as recorded in the New Testament. Now, carry it all a little further. It's really a separate subject. In what state of consciousness does the inner self of man abide? Supposing you or I, by meditation, thank you, or some other means, supposing we, by yoga, yes, by yoga, gave ourselves up to regular contemplation of the divine and obeying the yogic rules and living the yogic life means self-purifying, self-refining, so that we become more and more sensitized to the spiritual and less to the material, and we got glimpses and finally entered into knowledge of our real selves. What would it be like? Well, fortunately, again, mystics, poets, and others have told us. Nearly all of them agree in one matter, which is to describe it as an entry into light. To find oneself as a center of radiance in a vast and infinite ocean of light. Nearly all mystics so describe it. The sports and Paul, you remember, going along on the road to Damascus, Saul of Tarsus, imbued with the one idea that he had to destroy all Christians and the Christian religions, and starting out to do so. And suddenly, as he walked along the road, found himself enveloped in a tremendous light which all took his physical consciousness away almost. He fell to the ground and he heard a voice which said, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? The voice of his master, the great Lord Jesus, who stopped him on his path. Thereafter he arose and he was never the same person again. So light, yes, nearly always light, in intensity of light, in a vast sea of light. Other strange things, space limitations vanish. There's no here, no there. Or dare I put it, no geography at the causal level. Everything is here. I know this will sound nonsense because we can't quite easily translate it down into this brain, which says, well, there's that book and here over here is this one. You're there and I'm here. And we're absolutely accustomed to the limitations of space and geography. Not so. Not so. And once you touch the causal plane and causal levels of consciousness, all is here, one visionary put it. All is one. All beings are one. The sense of self-differentiation reduces until there's a sense of being at one with the divine life in all that exists. The goal of yoga, of course. Somebody's put it like this. Writers try to find words for this, which is wordless. One writer said, the adjacence of everything, everywhere. All is here. All is one. All beings are one. there is an intense happiness, a serene bliss, always accompanying entry into your own spiritual nature. And this, friends, this is the purpose of yoga, remember. Not the development of personal powers, but the attainment of union with God. And through that, with union with all that lives, and realization of one's God self in its veritable reality. And that is accompanied by a serene bliss. It's also accompanied by, how can I put it, a sharing of everybody else's life, of going through what they go through. John Donne, any man's death diminishes me because, he wrote, I am involved in all mankind. That's how the inner ego of man is involved with all mankind. You remember he went on, and therefore never send to know for whom the funeral bell tolls. Tolls, it tolls for thee. Another one has written of the burning oneness binding everything. And at this level, there's no I, no my, no mine. Such concepts can't exist, or what they can here, but not there, not there. There's unity, non-distinction. Which perhaps I can best describe as I close. I'll be dealing with all these matters later, friends, by telling a story. It's a story of the life of the Lord Sri Krishna, who represented the one supreme deity for a time, manifested in the semblance of the most beautiful human form, from childhood to manhood, and a mood about India, teaching these same divine ideas, especially oneness, unity. And especially that when once you touch the consciousness of the unity of yourself, you see that same divinity everywhere else. Here's a story. I'll close with it. There was a king in one of the kingdoms in northern India who was rather a tyrant and who demanded allegiance from all his people. And into this kingdom came the Lord Sri Krishna. And the same astonishing phenomenon occurred wherever he went. Everybody left everything they were doing to enter and be in his presence. And so he was asked to meet them. And a great meeting hall called a pandala was erected. And great crowds of people came from all walks of life to hear the Lord Sri Krishna. The king heard of this. He was enraged. He sent two policemen, go and arrest that man out of that hall and cast him into prison and see if people will want to follow him there. And so the two policemen came into the great hall by the door. There they saw the Lord Sri Krishna standing, teaching whole of the platform was covered with people, right down the long hall, all people listening to the Lord. And they drew near to arrest him. And lo, the person next to Sri Krishna was Sri Krishna. And the person on the other side of him, also Sri Krishna. And as they looked around, everybody on the platform was one being, the Lord Sri Krishna. See, when once you've seen the divine, you see it everywhere, in all. And so everybody was there, was Sri Krishna. Then they looked down the hall, and every single person there was the same being. Now, none other but the Lord Sri Krishna, the divine. So there really was nobody they could arrest. So they had to turn around and walk out. At the door, there was a rather large, full-size mirror. And as they walked out, they saw themselves in the mirror. And they were Sri Krishna too. Typical, you see. Now, once you touch this consciousness of the divine, which is your true self, you then are able to perceive and feel at one with, in a kind of exalted bliss, one with the divine in all others. This is causal consciousness, and this is one aspect of the consciousness of the immortal self of every man, robed in the causal body, known as, in theosophy, the ego in the causal body. Thank you. Some questions. At what stage in the embryonic development of man does the consciousness of the incoming ego enter the embryo? Unanswerable. Why? Because it's based, I think, upon an erroneous assumption. Let me put it this way. We'll be studying all this fairly soon, a little later on, and the whole procedure of the ego descending to birth and embryonic developments and so on. But as I understand it, it perhaps operates rather like this. At the moment of conception, when the first twin cell or zygote is formed, at that moment, the ego is linked with that twin cell. How and in what form, I will be explaining. It's rather too much to go into now. When we come to that subject, the descent of the ego to birth, but by a certain method, at that moment, a radiation from and through the ego of the divine is linked to that first twin cell in utero. And the whole of the embryo grows round it. So you see, it's not a question at what stage does the soul enter the body. It's there from the first moment and the body grows round it. That's my understanding, friend, of that. Now, I will be going into it more fully and with some illustrations later on. How long does the causal body last? Till man is more than man? Yes. I understand that's the theosophical teaching. Right on through all the stages of human incarnation and evolution right up to that third remarkable event to which I referred at the beginning, the attainment of adeptship. Then, the sense of separated individuality entirely disappears, and the causal body undergoes some such changes that it is no longer describable as such. Therefore, yes, I think I could thank you for your question. Yes, at the attainment of superhumanity, the causal body, having performed its task, I suppose, in nature's great procedures, then gives way to another form of the incarnation of the monad. Would you please discriminate between emotion and intellect in the causal body? You won't have any emotion in the causal body at all. You will have, take for example the emotion of love if you like, you will then have a realized experience of oneness, an intuitive and perfectly well-known fact that the spirit in you and the spirit in the beloved are one. And as for the intellect, it's non-conceptual. That is to say, the intelligent aspect of the ego in the causal body is deals with laws, processes, underlying principles, great procedures in nature, and the governing divine ideas under which they are occurring. So, egoic intellect is not conceptual. It's not twice two or four, or 5 miles from here to somewhere else, or all of the argumentative differences which so valuably we use in our purely mental bodies, but a kind of complete comprehension of the underlying principle. From that level, all is understood. Oh yes, I might use that word, understanding, instead of argumentation, research, and concepts. Difficult, excuse me if I fail, it's almost impossible to bring down into words with my limitations these differences, these subtle differences. You see, for example, the problem of time doesn't really enter into causal consciousness. There is no time there. There is what is called by duration, which means time without limits. Time always going on without any limits to it. Or, how can I put it? Yes, a time continuum. A time continuum, ever flowing. Not shut off like we are down here. For example, friends, our past lives, if you believe in reincarnation. Well, they certainly have their beginning and their end in time. Wherever they were in Atlantis and ancient Egypt or China or India or Egypt or Greece or Rome and on through the Middle Ages or wherever it was. Here we are incarnated here in the next one. But for the ego, there hasn't been any division at all. So there isn't a past lives at all. It's one continuing flow of experience.
And that, friends, concludes the talk by Mr. Geoffrey Hodson and his title, Man's Undying Reincarnating Spiritual Self.